You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast on distinguishing and managing early-stage Alzheimer's disease, leveraging interdisciplinary collaboration for prompt identification and optimal patient management. My name is Brad Dickerson. I'm the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Frontotemporal Disorders Unit and a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Joining me is my friend and colleague, Dr. David Wolk. Dave, glad to have you on the call today. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Hey, Brad. It's really great to be here today with you and have this discussion. I'm a cognitive neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm a professor of neurology. I direct our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and co-direct the Penn Memory Center here.
Great. Well, I was thinking we'd take our listeners through a couple of cases today that you and I can discuss. So let's start with our first case. We've got a man named Don who initially presented for symptoms of increasing forgetfulness over the past 1 to 2 years. I think he's 68. He notes that he had been taking more time to remember previously well-remembered life events and conversations, such as times and details of appointments with his doctor. Occasionally, he was missing doses of some of his daily medications, not fully remembering conversations and meetings with family and friends or planned visits with his children. His wife had noted a slight but noticeable and consistent increase in forgetfulness regarding recent conversations, life events, appointments, and misplacing of personal items. And on review of other symptoms, such as language, attention, concentration, executive function, visual spatial skills, personality and behavior, and sensory motor functions, those were all negative. His past medical history included dyslipidemia, gout, and a knee replacement. And his medications and supplements included atorvastatin, colchicine, over-the-counter chondroitin sulfate, and glucosamine. His family medical history was notable for his mother, who was thought to have had Alzheimer's dementia with onset in her 70s. She died at age 82. So with that background on this patient, Dave, what stands out to you so far?
Well, so I think, you know, this is a typical patient in many ways to what I'm sure we both see in our clinics. You know, this is a 68-year-old man where it's interesting, initially it described well-remembered life events, which makes me think of more remote pieces of information. But actually, you know, based on the description, it sounds like he's forgetting more recent events like conversations and appointments. And that's a sort of typical complaint of someone who has short-term memory failures. And I think importantly, and very helpfully, these concerns were corroborated by his wife. So, we often see quote unquote worried well patients who describe some changes in their memory, many of those that can be typical of normal aging. But the fact that his wife's also noticing some of these changes, I think at least raises some concern on my part. I think another salient feature from the description is that, you know, it doesn't seem like other aspects of thinking, at least based on the initial workup, are affected as well. So we're not hearing about issues with language or speech or judgment or changes in personality or other kinds of motor changes that might suggest a variety of different conditions. And so it sounds like, you know, we're dealing with someone who has a primarily amnestic type of presentation. And then moreover, it sounds like for the most part, although, you know, one could delve into a little bit more detail about this, that he's generally functioning pretty well in his day-to-day activities, but maybe is a little less efficient or makes some mistakes with regard to that. So he's someone that we might think of when we think of level of impairment as being kind of more in a mild cognitive impairment range with a primarily amnestic syndrome. And then I think, you know, we can talk a little bit more about what kinds of different conditions we might think about and work up at this point.
Great. So you're really taking the history and going into the examination with some clear hypotheses that you want to try to test. So he had a general physical examination that was completely unremarkable, given his overall healthy status, and a general neurologic exam that did not show any sensory or motor abnormalities, normal coordination, stance, gait, reflexes, and so forth. But on the office-based cognitive assessment, he did well in everything except the memory domain. So he learned the information that was presented to him reasonably well, maybe took a few extra trials, but then really couldn't retrieve it. And, you know, even when given multiple choice options, sometimes selected the incorrect option. So really, you know, seemed to have a clear evidence of rapid forgetting. So what are your thoughts with that additional examination information?
Yeah, so I think that really kind of confirms what you got from the history. And I think, you know, it's important to note that sometimes family members will describe, you know, memory problems. And then ultimately, when you actually do testing on them, you find, you know, other domains are affected. You know, even if based on your probing them about these domains, they might not equate them to quite the same thing that we do as clinicians. And so I think that the cognitive testing really kind of corroborates that what the patient's care partner also felt they had noticed as well. Again, not really hearing a lot about any kind of physical exam findings, which, you know, as a neurologist, one thinks about other kinds of conditions where one might have motor features, so things like Parkinsonism that might suggest something in the Lewy body spectrum. So I think what, again, we're seeing here is someone who has a amnestic presentation primarily on their cognitive testing. That's the most salient feature with relatively mild and still functioning fairly well day to day at this point.
Yeah, and I think you know, with some evidence in the office of amnesia, how do you help people understand that this is not just part of normal aging? Because of course everybody gets a little forgetful as we get older.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a kind of common question we'll get from our patients and family members, which is, well, you know, is this forgetfulness just sort of the typical forgetfulness that people get with aging, or does this reflect something more than that? I think, you know, a couple of red flags that we're seeing something a little bit more than just sort of typical aging are a few things. One is, it seems like, you know, this individual is really kind of losing information over time. And typically with normal aging, you see more of a problem with kind of pulling information out, but if appropriately cued, people are usually able to retrieve that information. Two, you know, I think the fact that it's having any kind of more significant impact on day-to-day things like remembering medicines gives me a little bit more concern, just in terms of not just the quality of the memory change, but also the quantity of the memory change. And three, you know, our psychometric tests to a large extent are normed to other people of similar age and background. And so the fact that he's also performing less well than what we expect in that context, you know, increases, you know, my concern that this is more than just typical aging. That being said, you know, the boundary between normal aging and, you know, the early signs of a more progressive process are somewhat blurred and can be challenging to differentiate.
So if his wife or he said, so does this mean I have dementia right now? What would you say to that question?
Yeah, so I think at this point, when we think of kind of level of impairment for this patient, I think he would fall into the mild cognitive impairment range of impairment based on the history, which is where he has some degree of cognitive impairment. It's been objectively confirmed by our testing. And where maybe he's a little less efficient in some of the things he does. So maybe like forgetting a dose of his medicine, but it sounds like he's still functioning fairly well. Again, that's something, you know, one might delve into deeper to get a better sense of instrumental activities of daily living, things that we talk about, like the checkbook, remembering medicine, shopping, and driving. But it seems like he's functioning fairly well in his day-to-day activities, but just is a little less efficient at them. And so I don't think he rises to a level of dementia level impairment, whereas opposed to inefficiencies, we're starting to talk about incapacities. So he's having where, you know, he wouldn't be able to manage his medicines at this point, or he wouldn't be able to use the checkbook. And so I would define it into this mild cognitive impairment category for the patient and family member in this instance.
So when you make a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment and explain all those things to patients and their family members, how do you answer the question that usually comes up, which is, okay, so, you know, what's going to happen? You know, is this going to get worse, or, you know, is this just going to be something I have to live with and it won't really get worse? Talk about prognosis maybe.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I have developed a sort of way I talk about mild cognitive impairment, and it definitely, you know, you tailor it to your patient and family members. But the first thing I usually start off about talking about mild cognitive impairment is it doesn't define a particular cause. It basically defines a syndrome where people are having more memory or other cognitive impairment than we expect for age, but not enough, again, as we discussed, to really incapacitate them, and that there's lots of different things that can cause mild cognitive impairment, one of which is conditions like Alzheimer's disease, so progressive neurodegenerative conditions, but other things certainly can cause mild cognitive impairment as well, vascular disease, you know, mood, low mood, poor sleep, medicines people are on, and again, even more quote-unquote robust normal aging can cause people to have a little bit more trouble in memory or thinking than we expect for age. So, to start, when someone has mild cognitive impairment, I say I'm not 100% sure what's driving these symptoms. That being said, mild cognitive impairment is likely enriched in people who do have some of these more progressive processes. And I usually quote something to the effect of, you know, when we see a patient in a clinic like our own with mild cognitive impairment, somewhere on the order of 5 to 15% of people per year will progress on in their cognitive impairment to where they're starting to have some incapacities, and where they're eventually moving on into a dementia stage. And that by 5 years, we expect around half the people to go on and develop some degree of dementia. And so that works out to about a threefold increase in your risk of progression to dementia relative to someone without these symptoms who come in to the office. But then we'll also have a discussion about, well, what can we do to further refine that prognosis? And a lot of that then involves getting additional kinds of studies that better hone in on what the potential cause potentially is in this particular instance. And that may further refine what we expect the prognosis to be.
Great. So if we start with our usual workup of doing a lab panel for common comorbid conditions and an MRI, and they came back normal, you might still counsel them in general on brain healthy behaviors, like we're in the American Academy of Neurology's 2018 MCI guidelines, like exercise and healthy diet and so forth. But what kinds of topics would you bring up with people about referrals for additional kinds of testing at this point to try to figure out more about what the cause might be?
Yeah, so I think one is, you know, usually and not too uncommonly, that's how the results do come back. You know, we get an MRI that, you know, maybe shows a little bit of small vessel ischemic disease, and maybe we can convince ourselves there's a little bit of atrophy in parts of the brain that, you know, might be associated with conditions like Alzheimer's. But generally, you know, it's sort of nonspecific what we see on the MRI, and the laboratory workup is negative. And so we often have a discussion about to what extent the patient wants to better understand what their prognosis is and what the underlying cause is. And, you know, we have some patients who really want to kind of learn what the underlying cause is, because that will have prognostic implications. If it turns out their mild cognitive impairment is due to Alzheimer's, it's obviously likely, if not inevitable, that it's going to progress. Whereas if they don't have Alzheimer's, you know, they still could have another progressive condition, but there tends to be a greater likelihood of non-progressive types of things that can affect them. And so we'll often have that conversation, one, just to get a sense of how much they want to know the diagnosis, and that may drive referral for additional testing. However, as you know quite well, we've also entered a new age in our field where there are also now disease-modifying medicines for Alzheimer's disease, these anti-amyloid immune-based medicines, one of which is fully FDA approved, another that may be on the way in the future. And because of these new disease-modifying medicines that seem to be most optimal when people are at the mildest stage of Alzheimer's disease, we now often have a discussion, well, would you want to be aggressive about trying to treat this condition? And if so, then we ought to find out whether or not you have underlying Alzheimer's disease. And if they do, then we'll often refer them for additional tests. We're a specialty clinic, but I could imagine that also might be a pivot point in a more primary care office for referring to a specialist at that point to get additional data points.
Great. And so what are some of the go-to tests that you would use to try to figure out whether the person like Dawn has Alzheimer's disease as the driver behind the MCI?
Yeah, so right now, probably the most common one we use is lumbar puncture to measure cerebrospinal fluid markers of Alzheimer's disease, which are, there's years of data supporting the validity of these measures. And there are a couple FDA approved measures that are now in practice that we use to help define whether or not people have the markers suggestive of Alzheimer's disease. So that's one of the tests that we get, and it tends to be well covered by insurance and relatively minor procedure. I will say prior to anti-amyloid therapies, a lot of patients were resistant to spinal fluid studies because the test really only had kind of prognostic implications. But now that it has therapeutic implications, many of our patients are very willing to go on and get a lumbar puncture. The other test that is now also covered by Medicare that we get is amyloid PET imaging, which can allow us to visualize whether there's amyloid in the brain. And if there is, that would be supportive that there. This patient's mild cognitive impairment is associated with underlying Alzheimer's disease. Although I will say that it's somewhat harder to get coverage or for sites to run amyloid PET based on how reimbursement works. So we've generally skewed more towards getting spinal fluid studies in our patients at this point.
Great. And so then obviously if a man like Don had a spinal fluid result that came back showing abnormal amyloid, total tau, and phospho-tau consistent with AD, then you would potentially talk with him about the new therapy that you mentioned.
Yeah. So, I think we kind of have that conversation throughout with our patients. So even just referring them to, you know, get one of these tests, we'll have sort of seeded those conversations. But certainly if the results came back consistent with Alzheimer's disease in this particular scenario, we would think it's very likely that Alzheimer's is the primary driver of this person's symptoms and that they were at a very mild stage of the disease and likely to be really good candidates for these drugs. And so we would go over these drugs. There are a couple other things we do in assessment of these patients to further understand their risk of these therapies. But generally at that point, we would really kind of move into the stage of sort of dotting a few I's and crossing T's to make sure that this patient's appropriate for anti-amyloid therapy and complete that workup and likely refer them to it if they're interested.
Great. Well, thanks for taking us through that foundational case. I think it's really a prototype of the types of patients that we want to be trying to diagnose at an early enough stage to treat them with these new medications. So let's spend a little bit of time that we have left going quickly through one more case. So this is an 80-year-old man who feels that his thinking is just not what it should be and what it used to be. So he really self-initiated the visit. His father had a stroke and died at age 71. Mother died of a stroke, also older. This man is a computer scientist and had a job as a computer data analyst, but retired, but continues to work part-time with his daughter as a programmer. He has hypertension, atrial fibrillation, hypercholesterolemia. He's on amlodipine, hydrochlorothiazide, temesartan, apixaban, and rovastatin. His wife has noticed that he occasionally has difficulty finding some words and recalling recent information, and he seems to need to double-check his work a little bit more than he used to. Sometimes he relies on her for directions while driving, forgot to pay a bill recently. Again, a lot of things that may seem to be kind of minor, typical changes of normal aging, but that he's concerned about. His daughter that he works with sometimes says that he's not had any decrement in his ability to write the code that he helps her with. So she is a little less concerned. But he wanted to be evaluated to try to figure out if there's a reason for this, and if so, if there's something that can be done about it. His basic labs were normal. They were done by his PCP, and he had a mental status exam that looked pretty good. His neurologic exam was good. General physical exam was good. But he had difficulty with serial sevens on the MoCA, Montreal Cognitive Assessment, and didn't do very well on letter fluency. But the rest of the test was fully intact, including the encoding and recall portions of the memory testing. So what do you think about this case and your thoughts about how he would fit onto this same kind of pipeline of evaluation?
Yeah, so I think he's an interesting case. I think the first thing that, you know, is hard not to stand out about this patient is the number of vascular risk factors this patient has. So he's got a number of, a family history of stroke. It looks like he's on blood pressure medicine. He's on a cholesterol medicine. He's on a couple of blood pressure medicines, and also, you know, on anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation. And so clearly your mind as a clinician is very much starting to think, okay, could there be a vascular cause to what's going on here? And then, I think much like the other patient, I think he's someone when I'm just hearing about his level of impairment, I'm thinking he's someone who has a little bit of inefficiencies in what he's doing, but clearly, you know, is still able to work at a high level. And so at most, you know, before even getting his cognitive testing, you would say he falls into a mild cognitive impairment category if he even shows evidence of objective impairment on testing. But he indeed did show some areas where he struggled with, mostly in the areas of executive functioning and sort of what we call frontal networks types of issues. So trouble with retrieving letters, the letter fluency task, how many letters or how many words can you come up with that begin with a particular letter, really requires a lot of organization and focus to come up with and retrieve those words. And so it's a very significant executive function task, as is serial sevens, where you kind of have to keep the information online and manipulate that information to remember what number you're on and to keep subtracting by sevens. And so while, you know, by history, he shows a lot of the same kind of forgetfulness maybe that last patient showed, on his psychometric testing, he shows a very different profile, which I think speaks to the fact that, you know, attention, focus, executive function can sometimes, you know, particularly to a non-clinician, kind of look like the same kind of memory impairment that someone who has a more classic, what we'd call temporolimbic memory impairment has as well. And so I think in his case, I think he probably does fit into a mild cognitive impairment category with a primarily executive, dysexecutive type of impairment.
Great. So what would be one of the key tests you would want to see right off the bat in a guy like this going after your initial hypothesis?
Yeah, so he'd be someone that I would want to get an MRI scan and to, basically assess the degree to which there's evidence of cerebrovascular disease on imaging.
Yeah, so he had an MRI and it showed non-specific age-related atrophy, but also patchy periventricular white matter hyperintensities and a couple of small lacunes. So what are your thoughts at this point?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the imaging supports the fact that there is a fair bit of sort of downstream cerebrovascular disease and comports well to the testing. And so my suspicion would be relatively high that this reflects vascular cognitive impairment. That being said, oftentimes vascular cognitive impairment can occur in conjunction with Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative conditions, but we particularly think about mixed Alzheimer's and vascular cognitive impairment. We often see people who have MRIs that look like what was described here who have no symptoms. I still would wonder about whether or not there was underlying Alzheimer's disease and still might have a discussion thinking about that diagnosis with this particular patient, keeping in mind that with regard to anti-amyloid therapies, he has one of the major contraindications to taking one of those drugs, which is that he's on anticoagulation, which would put him at higher risk for some of the bleeding side effects of these drugs. And therefore, I think if we moved on to additional testing, it would be more for diagnostic, prognostic purposes than it necessarily would be for making a decision on treating with an anti-amyloid therapy.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunately a pretty common scenario that we're seeing a lot these days as people are coming to us to get these types of evaluations. So obviously, you know, he could be one of the relatively uncommon cases that you've talked about that where it's purely vascular cognitive impairment and not a co-occurring neurodegenerative disease. He is 80 years old. So as you've also said, I think it's becomes more the rule rather than the exception that people have more than one disease that may be contributing to the cognitive symptoms that they have when they get into that age demographic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, if you had to bet, it'd be more likely that this is mixed than it is just vascular cognitive impairment. Again, one could have a conversation with this patient in terms of, do they want to get additional testing to try to better understand their prognosis? Obviously, if they didn't have evidence of Alzheimer's disease, vascular cognitive impairment on its own tends to be a bit more of an indolent process than Alzheimer's disease. And so they still might be very interested in trying to learn more about the likelihood that they have underlying Alzheimer's disease. Potentially also, if depending on the nature of available trials, they also might be someone who might be interested in pursuing a research study to treat Alzheimer's disease that might not have the same contraindications. And so, you know, if there are people who want to be really kind of aggressive about what's going on in this context, then maybe you would sort of proceed with additional testing.
To see whether he might be a candidate for a clinical trial, you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I think based on the history and his high level of functioning, clearly this is a family who has some interest in having things evaluated as soon as possible. And so sometimes that personality might lend itself to someone who really wants to be as aggressive as possible. And I think, you know, there are other trials out there that don't have these same side effects that the anti-amyloid medicines do.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dave. It's all the time we have. And again, I'd like to thank Dr. David Wolk for taking the time to speak with us today about these scenarios surrounding early diagnosis and management of MCI and dementia. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I'd like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Thank you and have a great day.